The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So last week we started a conversation about not self. And we got partway through it. So I wanted to continue that. How many of you were here last week? Okay, so some of you were not here. So let me just start by giving a little bit of a definition of this characteristic of not self, just as a little review. This aspect of anatta, not self, the Pali term for not self is anatta, is usually taught or is often taught within the context of three characteristics that are universal to every experience that we have. That whenever we meet our experience, moment to moment meeting our experience, we begin to recognize that what happens to us, the experiences that we meet, the first thing that we often recognize in terms of a quality that is universal or applicable to all of our experience is that everything is impermanent. That when we start looking at our experience, we see that nothing stays. And as we look more meditatively and more deeply, we actually see that nothing stays for very long at all. Things actually are changing pretty quickly. Now, this characteristic of impermanence is relatively easy to understand for us. We understand that things come and go. It's not a surprise to us that things come and go. But the actuality of this characteristic of impermanence, of applying to every single moment of experience, actually does come as a little bit of a surprise to us when we really meet it, when we really touch into that experience. And this is a little bit the distinction between an understanding, an intellectual kind of understanding of this teaching of impermanence, and the insight level of understanding of this teaching of impermanence. That when we actually see something in an experience, if we meet some experience, the sound of a bird, just the sound, and we're right there with it, and then it vanishes in a split second. It can be a little shocking. It's like, wow, that thing was there and now it's gone. That's really touching into that quality of impermanence directly, as opposed to mediated through our ideas about impermanence. So impermanence, this understanding of impermanence at the experiential level, is really the kind of ground, or often the first kind of recognition that we can relatively easily touch into in our experience. From that recognition that things are impermanent, that nothing lasts for very long, we begin to have an understanding and appreciation that there's nothing in our experience that can possibly be satisfying for any lasting period of time, because things come and go. And this is the characteristic, the second characteristic, the characteristic of unsatisfactoriness. Dukkha, the dukkha characteristic, that's the Pali term for it. The not-self characteristic, which is the third, also in a sense follows out of those two. In a way it follows out of those two, but it is a harder one to understand. It is the recognition that there's nothing in our experience, nothing that we can possibly meet with our experience, in our meeting of experience, that qualifies as me or mine or who I am. Last week I asked some of you, what do you consider me or I? What is your own personal definition of self? And I got some of the following answers. It's the one who thinks they're in control, a sense of solidity, the one who chooses or decides, a feeling of separateness of me and you, something that carries the continuity of life, something that carries that thread from past to present to future. And one of the ways to explore this teaching around self and not self is to begin to look at that idea that you have of what is yourself and recognize what in your experience you are taking as self. So a sense of solidity, for example, if we kind of touch into that feeling of solidity of I or me, what is that solidity? What is that experience? Can we look at it from various perspectives? Is it solidity in the body? Is it a solidity of feeling? Is it a solidity of an emotion or a mood? A sense that, yep, this way that I feel right now, this is me. Is it a sense of the familiarity of the physicality of the body? What is it? What is it that you feel as you? And in looking at that, if you turn with your mindfulness and look at the experience that feels like me or I am, what happens? Does it stay the same? Or does it change? So the Buddha, in his exploration of this notion of self, of not self, pointed us to look at five areas of our experience that we tend to particularly identify with. We look at these five areas and say, yep, body, that's me. Feeling, yep, that's me. So there's five areas, and they're called in the Pali. I mean, the translation is often the five aggregates. How many of you were here from my talk on the five aggregates on Sunday? Okay, so I'll do a little review of this also. So aggregate, you know, aggregate sounds like a technical term, kind of dry, uninteresting term. And the term that it's translating from the Pali is khanda. And that term was not a technical term in the time of the Buddha. It was a very normal, day-to-day term that meant something like bundle or heap. You might, you know, have a khanda of stones. So it's, you know, think about what a heap is or what a bundle is. It's something made of other things. And so it's this kind of notion of a collection of things. And so the Buddha looked at our experience, and in terms of this process of selfing, of this notion of I arising, because that's what it actually is, that what we consider to be self is actually it's a process that arises on an ongoing basis that we impute a kind of reality to. So in looking at that process of identification that happens to us, the Buddha saw that there were these five collections of things that were particularly useful in terms of distinguishing, that we tend to identify around these five areas. And these five areas are, one, the body, and then the other four are aspects or processes that go on in the mind. And they are this process of simply knowing experience, so the process of just recognizing something as being known, just meeting directly experience. So the knowing aspect, there's a feeling aspect of whether something is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. There's a recognition aspect, this thing I pointed to in the guided meditation around identifying what's happening in our experience. That, you know, we hear something and we recognize it as bird, or we hear something and we recognize it as door. So that recognition process, the feeling process, the knowing process, they're kind of really tightly intertwined in terms of being the way we kind of meet our experience, recognize our experience. There are different aspects of that recognition of experience. And we can't really tease them apart. They're like three facets. If you could have a three-sided gem, it would be like three facets of experience. And sometimes we can look more through one side, we can really notice the feeling side, the quality of whether something's pleasant or unpleasant. We can notice more the fact that the mind is recognizing what's happening moment to moment, identifying, seeing man, seeing carpet, seeing woman, seeing color, seeing wall, hearing, truck. All of that is the recognition aspect. And then the knowing aspect, which is a little harder to kind of get underneath, to tease apart from those two of feeling and perceiving. But it's said to be more just the bare meeting of experience, just meeting it without necessarily identifying it. So kind of meeting seeing as seeing and not the recognition or parsing it into form, color, or objects. The bare meeting of hearing is hearing, the hearing, knowing of hearing. So those are those three. And then the fourth mental aspect is what is called mental formations, which is essentially where it's kind of this place of choice, place of intention happens. Almost everything that happens in our mind, except for these aspects of feeling, perceiving, and knowing, lies in this area of formations. So all of our emotions, our thoughts, our moods, moods from the range of anger, frustration, irritation, annoyance, desire, all of that kind of emotion, as well as states like calm, tranquility, equanimity, mindfulness, peace. All of those also fall in this category of mental formations. The mental formations are essentially what shape our experience. So they're kind of what move us through when some kind of mental formation arises. It tends to construct our experience of subsequent moments. It kind of propels us into further moments. I'll give an example on this. I gave this example on Sunday. If anger arises, that's one of these mental formations. If anger arises, it impacts all of our experience. It impacts our body through perhaps tension, tightness, heat, pressure in the body. It impacts our feeling. So here I'm going again through these five aggregates. It impacts our feeling. It impacts, generally with anger, our feeling is unpleasant. It impacts our perception that when we're angry, we tend to perceive things through that lens of anger. I have an example about this on one retreat, experiencing quite a bit of aversion, doing some walking meditation, just feeling just flooded with this aversion, and my eyes landing on somebody's shoes at the end of the path, just immediately I was like, why does somebody have their shoes there? So the perception, the recognition was imbued with that anger. I mean, shoes are kind of neutral.
Good thing it wasn't a person.
So perception is impacted, that when we have that anger, we see things through that filter of anger. Our consciousness, again, this filter of anger not only perhaps alters our perception, our recognition as being a kind of inherently awful thing that those shoes are there, but it may tend to draw our attention to certain things and not to other things. So what comes into our experience, that what meets our consciousness, may be filtered. It's like having, you know, a lens of Swiss cheese. It only letting in things that, we don't particularly want to have around us, thereby confirming our attitude of anger. So that lens of anger changes not only our perception, but also tunes us to be particularly selective about what we are conscious of. So that shaping the consciousness. And then there's the fact that when we are angry, if we are just, riding that wave of anger and just, going with it and kind of indulging in it, it tends to create more anger. So it tends to shape more of that mental formation of anger. So the mental formation area is a pretty crucial piece. It's kind of where that notion of creating, constructing our experience comes from. And so looking at that area can be a key for us in terms of shaping and constructing skillful versus unskillful experience. So in looking at these five aggregates, and one teacher, Anna Lyle, has a beautiful way of pointing to how we see self in these five things. I'll see if I can remember them. He says, the body is where I am. Feeling is how I am. The perceiving is what I am perceiving. The formations, I may have to look this up. Formations are... I'm sorry? Oh, he says, formations, volitions, essentially, are why I am acting, why I am. And consciousness is whereby I am experiencing. So the this is kind of how we get pulled into this notion of self, that with each of these experiences we have some sense that I am, where I am, how I am, why I am. And the I part is actually an afterthought. There is the where, the why, and the how. And the I part of that is a construction. And that's hard to understand. I mean, part of this difficulty of this teaching is that it's most of us listen to this kind of teaching from the perspective of I am. And this perspective has a really hard time understanding this teaching. A really hard time. So, one of the ways the Buddha approached this is to kind of an exploration of these five aggregates, exploring with people. First of all, he started from what people generally think of as self. And often what people think of as self is this sense of control, of being in control, that I am the one who is in control. And so he started with each of these and he said, okay, let's look at the body. So let's do this. Let's look at our body. Can we say, may my body be thus? Body, do this. Or body, don't do that. We don't actually have this kind of control over the body. And then the Buddha questions, is something that we don't have control over worthy of being called self? He does the same for the others. So let's think about each one. So feeling, how we're feeling, whether our experience is coming in as a feeling of pleasantness or unpleasantness, can we willfully choose to have that either continue or stop like that? Is it dependent rather on the situation? We can, the way I think we work with this is if we're feeling something that we don't like, we use one of these other aggregates, like choosing to pay attention. We redirect our attention. So we'll get to that one, choice, in a moment. So feeling, then perception. Now again, now perception is an interesting one. Can we choose how our perception works? Or is our perception actually kind of conditioned from the past? And were we responsible for how that perceptual conditioning happened? Or was it a series of causes and conditions? Having been exposed to particular birds in particular locations, we may, in our perception of bird, at least in my experience with recognizing how perception works, I see that when I hear a bird, I get this vague memory, or not memory so much, but image in the mind of, usually there's a tree involved. And there's, you know, a vaguely bird-shaped thing sitting on a branch. There's often a little movement because the bird is chirping. And, you know, my sense is that that vague image has been constructed based on my experience of having seen birds in trees, in particular kinds of trees. In my particular tree tends to be kind of a hardwood tree, like a maple tree or something like that. I don't tend to envision birds in evergreen trees. So this process of perception and how that perception comes to be is shaped. And do I have control over how that perception arises? Do we have control over perception? Can we say, may my perception be thus, may my perception not be thus? I think most of us have the sense that this perception process, if you pay attention, like in the guided meditation, I actually took you through four of the aggregates. I didn't go to the aggregate of consciousness, but through the hearing exploration, I encouraged you to recognize this process of perception, that as you heard something, recognizing the difference between the sound and the recognition of it. Now, how many of you had a sense of that distinction? Did you notice what I was talking about? Have a sense of that? And what did you notice?
I noticed that I was really quick to judge, and it took me some time to just separate the two.
Okay, so the judgment piece you were noticing.
I noticed, like the car, I recommend, I put that word right.
Okay, so you heard...
Instead of listening to the sound, I just labeled it right away.
Okay, so the labeling, you noticed it as a kind of a word, mm-hmm. that you said car. That's another very frequent way that we had that this perception process happens for us. You know, we're sitting here and we hear something and say, oh, motorcycle, oh, person, oh, door, oh, Velcro. You know, just like that. Is that something that you have a sense that you are doing? Or is it just a process? It is, you can condition?
One can condition.
One.
Condition.
It is conditioned, absolutely.
But when you address that conditioning, can change the condition.
Absolutely, yes. Or how the mind meets the experience.
Right, so initially it's sound, car immediately, but then over time you recognize the connection. The bare sensation,
mm-hmm.
and that goes with emotion too, right? Any of these compounded things.
Yes. So I'll get to this notion. I mean, because I think underlying your question is the sense of, so how does change happen if there's not someone here doing it?
Well, I can see how change happens when somebody's not doing it.
Okay. Okay, good. we'll just the perception is definitely conditioned. It's been conditioned throughout our lives, and the attention to it. You know, there's this notion of the Heisenberg principle in science. I don't know if any of you are familiar with this. There's this notion that observing phenomena changes the outcome. And that's essentially what the process of mindfulness does. When we begin to observe what's going on, it shapes the conditioning. It is a process. It is one of those mental formations that shapes experience. So when mindfulness arises and it's recognized and cultivated, and how that happens, I mean, it's all a series of conditions happening. You know, it's a series of conditions that have happened to bring you here, to listen to the teaching. It's a series of conditions that have happened that incline the mind to be interested in exploring the teaching. All these things, the interest, the exploration, the hearing of the teachings, things that brought us here, are all conditioned. So the seeing of the conditioning, the conditioned nature of these aggregates is for me, that's one of the main ways of really beginning to understand this not self-teaching. That there's no I directing this conditioning. It is what is arising in the mind at a particular time that directs that conditioning. So if mindfulness and clarity of seeing arise in the mind at a particular moment, it tends to direct the movement of experience in one direction towards being able to see suffering and let go of it, let go of the clinging that causes suffering. If anger arises in the mind in a moment, it tends to direct the mind towards other things. And so this quality of mindfulness is this observation. It's this observing experience, and it tends to change experience. So this is really our key. It's the key towards this process of change. And we are all fortunate enough to have stumbled into the teachings of mindfulness, heard them, and in that hearing, my understanding of kind of how this works, in that hearing of the teaching of the Dharma and of mindfulness, the mind begins to recognize this quality and an interest arises in cultivating it. That interest creates the ground for the process of the meditation to unfold. So it kind of feels like we're choosing. It feels like I'm choosing to come. I'm choosing to meditate. So this area of choosing is a huge area that we identify. It's, I think, probably one of the main areas. So there's the control aspect that I'm controlling, which is related to this notion of choosing, that I'm the one that's choosing. With choice, and again, we can look at this, what happens around choice? And this, in turning attention to what is happening moment to moment, we start to see choice as it arises. We see that choice comes into being based on conditions. And that this feeling that I am choosing is actually something that happens after the fact. So a choice happens, and there's a sense of, I did that. I did that. So there's the, for instance, I think I gave this example last week. You're sitting at your desk for a long time, and that is a condition. You're doing something. You're engaged. Taxes. I was sitting at my desk for hours doing taxes the other day. And after some period of time sitting there, pressure in the bladder arises. That pressure in the bladder conditions the wish to relieve that pressure. And that wish to relieve that pressure conditions an intention to move, just to get up. And that intention to move or get up conditions the moving. That there, this whole process of that choice to get up and go to the bathroom to relieve that pressure, when we really come into the moment and see moment to moment, it's just a series of cause and condition, cause and effect, cause and effect, cause and effect, cause and effect, effect becoming cause, effect, effect becoming cause, effect. So the this is not easy to see. It actually takes a kind of a quieter mind to actually start to recognize this. But there are times when we can just so clearly see. It's like dominoes falling. You know, you're just in a space. You can be in a space of just presence and watching how the mind does its thing. Just dominoes. Dominoes falling. Cause and effect, cause and effect. So another place that we really come back to in terms of identification, so let's say I've talked about body, feeling, perception, consciousness. And again, looking at the notion of control. Can we say about our consciousness, may it be thus? May it not be thus? So again, this notion of control. Do we really have control in a moment to say what our experience is? Our experience has arisen based on causes and conditions. It is in this moment, here already. In then the last one, the mental formations, again. And this one perhaps is, a little bit more, maybe a little easier to see. I mean, there's strong emotion arises. And we often have a sense of being somewhat at the mercy of our emotions. That we feel like, why do I keep responding in this way, in this situation? You know, if I could change this, I would. We end up in these patterns, these habits that have been conditioned, a result of conditions. These patterns, these habits that we just, it's like they're so entrenched that we, get close to them. It's like a ball dropping into a rut. And there we are, just engaging in that pattern again. And many of us have the feeling like, if I could stop this, I would. And we usually don't have the sense that we have that kind of control. So I'm just going to just stop there for a minute. There's more I can say about this particular exploration, but I just wanted to see what's going on. What are you thinking? What's... Oh, yes, the microphones are helpful. Bud. And then, your name again?
Bill.
Bill, okay.
So where I get stuck in self is an addiction to sense pleasure. Sometimes hard for me to give up. And I think that addiction perpetuates my sense of self.
So the exploration around this is simply, again, you know, the mindfulness, paying attention with mindfulness. What is the sense pleasure? And can you, in a sense of, you know, looking at this, see where does the identification come in? Can you see for yourself what is the part that you're attaching to? Is it the pleasure? Is it the feeling? Is it some idea that I'm in control by moving from pleasure to pleasure? That there's a sense of, I can construct my life in this way.
Well, it's like being addicted to chocolate or enjoying chocolate. I see a piece of chocolate and I lose any sense of wanting to explore it. I just want to eat it. So, you know, the question of self, not self, isn't pertinent at that point.
Okay.
So, I'm just saying where I get lost.
Okay, you know? so that's where you get lost. Now, yeah. One thing, I think Michelle McDonald at one point said, she kind of had a similar experience, and she reported this on one retreat. And she said what she decided to do about this, she had a bar of chocolate in her room. I think it was a pretty big bar of chocolate. And she decided she was going to mindfully just completely eat that chocolate and see what happened. You know, what is going on? Not to try to not eat the chocolate, but to, while you're eating it. And actually, she said, I told myself I had to eat the whole thing. And she got sick. and thereby said she kind of learned that not only the whole process around that craving, you know, but, you know, kind of the impact or the result of that craving. So, you know, can you in that maybe shift your exploration from being not eating it to eating it? And what happens to you as you eat it? As you eat this thing, you know, okay, so you've got that craving, and it's like, okay, yep, I'm going to do that. So there's that intention that has arisen. Now, do you have a sense here? I mean, this is another piece that's really helpful to notice, actually, in this process. Is it the I that says, I'm going to do this? Or is it the conditioning that's propelling you into doing this? And, you know, so this piece that I pointed to last week a little bit, that there's actually evidence out there for the truth of this not-self-teaching. But we don't tend to pay attention to that. You know, it's like you say, you get lost. You know, is it the you getting lost, or is it the you who doesn't want to get lost? Where's the identification there? And so is there a feeling that I lose control there? So looking, just exploring that aspect, but you know, just, you know, doing the exploration, say, okay, not trying to stop, not eat the chocolate. Eat the chocolate. Eat it. Keep eating it until you realize where the craving stops.
Well, it's maybe like pheromones when you're in the presence of something that really pulls you in, and you kind of lose the sense of distinction, and then you have to go back and say, is this reaction, is there any self in this reaction, or is it just the natural causes and conditions arising?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's, of course, the natural causes and conditioning arising. We're conditioned by nature to be attracted to these pheromones. And but, you know, it's a depth of exploration that I seldom take the time to develop.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
It's just interesting.
So just see if you can find a way to explore it, not with some idea that it has to look in a particular way. So mm-hmm. in terms of thinking about exploring that eating of mm-hmm. chocolate, mm-hmm. What is your notion of that exploration? What did it mean?
Is it skillful or unskillful to eat the chocolate? And ultimately, it's unskillful.
Okay, so you have the idea in your mind that being mindful means you won't eat the chocolate.
No. And this takes me back to your point about being mindful that noise has happened and understanding that it's a car or not a car. And so this happens whether you're there or not, actually, right?
Yes.
It's like the tree falls in the forest. Does hearing occur? And I think yes to that. Because the noise arises whether or not you're there to...
Well, let's say the sound waves arise. The sound waves arise.
Right, and if you happen to...
If there's no receiver there...
Yeah, they're still there.
The sound waves are still there.
The sound waves are still there. So is mindfulness there. Anyway, this can get kind of complicated. I accept... self as a concept. But it's useful to have it.
It's definitely a useful concept. It's absolutely a useful concept.
Yeah.
And you know, with the exploration around it isn't that we're trying to get rid of something, because there's nothing there to get rid of, but we're trying to see a process for what it is rather than what we think it is.
Because if you see the process, it helps you let go.
Yes. Yes.
And it also helps me, though, to accept, okay, yeah, there is a concept of self. It's really useful when I go to buy a shirt or something like that. You know, my measurements are such and such.
And you know, you're not going to lose that concept. I mean, we don't have to worry that an opening into this not-self reality is going to make us non-functional in the world.
Just one more comment. In the absorption meditations, it seems to me that it's easier to experience no self.
It's
because
it's also there also can be a very subtle mm-hmm. clinging to those states. So there is a falling away of what we normally think of as self, but there can still be an identification. I'm experiencing just really subtle. So, but you're right that there's much, the kind of obvious notions of self are falling away in that. Yeah.
Well, while you were dialoguing, I couldn't help but wonder whether the example of the chocolate would apply effectively to Tiger Woods and his addiction. My real question, I think, is then these teachings that you've been explaining or conveying from the Buddha must have arisen within some context or process, and did not originate with the Buddha. Is that an accurate surmise?
The kind of understanding is that the conditioning or the process that that the Buddha underwent created the conditions for him to understand things in a way that had not been previously kind of in the milieu of his surroundings. But yes. I mean, there's stories of lifetimes of the Buddhas practicing, essentially creating and sculpting his mind stream that took him to the place where his exploration of moment-to-moment experience revealed this to him, and he had the capacity to articulate it. So it's not his. And in fact, he claims, you know, the way he put it is that he... he rediscovered something that was already there, not that he created something. Yeah.
I think it's a two-part question. One.
You hold the microphone a little closer.
Okay. It's a two-part question. One is I can understand how there's no like solid self, sort, and that it's always changing. But I'm thinking there's a lot more to this teaching that I'm not getting, which I can kind of accept for now. But I think one of my more important questions is, can you talk more about the benefits of understanding? Because then I might try harder. I
mean, yeah, okay. This question also came up last week. I think that was, was that your question? No.
Could you speak to that a little bit?
Okay. Yeah, I'll say a few words about that. So the understanding is that this process of selfing, of creating a self, is completely tied up with the process by which suffering is created. That when we identify with something, we claim it as I, me, or mine. By its inherent nature, that thing that we have claimed is subject to change. And therefore, we have claimed this thing, and when it changes, we suffer. So the and you know, looking at this from the perspective of suffering, and maybe that's where I'll go with this next week, because there's a teaching in one of the questions. A couple of the questions last week were, how do we cultivate the ability to recognize this characteristic? A couple of you were looking at that. The Buddha has several teachings around how to recognize it. In exploring this process of suffering, which is a little easier for us to perhaps meet, and we can, the Buddha understands the process of suffering and the process of selfing to be inherently the same process. And so looking at our suffering is kind of the initial meeting of experience. We don't really need to try to understand this teaching of not self, but meet what you experience as suffering and see if you can understand that through just being attentive to it. Not an intellectual understanding, but an experiential understanding. What is this suffering? How does the suffering come to be? That will lead you to seeing a little bit of this process of identification within the stream of suffering. So the places that we suffer, the reasons we suffer, are intimately tied up with this process of selfing. Now, one other piece that, you know, people, in hearing this teaching, in hearing the teaching of not self, usually from the perspective of self, there's a sense often of, and I talked about this some last week too, a sense often of a fear of, you know, am I going to disappear, or what's going to happen to me if I let go of this feeling of self, like the question of, am I going to be able to go to the store and buy a shirt, or, you know, what's going to happen to me? Am I going to be able to drive a car? Am I going to be able to go to work? You know, am I going to disappear? You know, what's going to happen if myself goes away? So there's normally this kind of fear, and that fear is coming from this perspective of self. So the self, because it has no concept of self, has been created, and it thinks it's real, and therefore it thinks it's going to die, with this teaching of not self. So to meet this teaching of not self from the perspective of self is to meet a teaching of death. And so we don't like this. But one of the interesting things about this teaching, you know, actually, and I'll try to keep this really short, you know, the teaching, the three characteristics, anicca, impermanence, suffering, dukkha, and anatta, not self, you know, we hear the teaching of impermanence and we say, yeah, I understand that. And when we actually meet this experience of impermanence, we actually recognize that everything, moment to moment, is just vanishing. That's a pretty scary experience, actually. It feels really unstable. Like, where do I land? How do I? So the meeting of that truth of impermanence feels really scary. The thought of it isn't particularly scary to us. You know, yeah, impermanence, I know impermanence. The teaching on not-self is scary to this notion of self. But when we meet that truth of not-self in our experience, it is a relief. It is a complete sense of, wow, I have been constructing and carrying a burden around with me that is illusory, not necessary. And it feels so good to see that and recognize that. So the insight into not-self actually has a sense of relief associated with it.
The question you said, where do I land? Does that answer come about naturally when?
Well, there's a period in practice with when you meet this instability where the mind has to adjust to the fact that there is nowhere to land. There's nowhere to land. So it feels to me like it. There's a period of particularly being in that space where it feels unsettling. It's like a new way of being in the world. It's like, whoa, I don't know about this. So it's a process of meeting that more deeply, in fact. That the unsettling nature of it actually has to do with a clinging to somebody that feels like it's disappearing. So now we need to stop. And I guess I'll continue a little next week talking about the process by which we can explore some of the teachings that the Buddha gave around exploring this. So thank you for your attention.